terrestrial concerns, the divine orders are sensed by the inner perceptions and rendered knowable by the forms which perpetuate their impulses. It is said that in ancient days God walked in the garden, and the light that was with him illumined the parts thereof. Nor is deity today any more distant than yesterday. For the maker of things still blesses his creations with his proximity. The growing grain, the ripening fruit, the tender shoots rising from the dark brown mold, the soft-eyed kine grazing on the hillside, the laughter of men, all these bear evidence of the invisible but ever-present maker. God is in his world, and although men cannot gaze into his face and live, they may gaze upon his works, and if they look rightly shall receive life more abundantly. The world is a symbol of the permanence of God, life a symbol of the presence of God, and love a symbol of the understanding of God. To those who are able to sense the inner life of things and read into forms even a small part of that great agency which actually ensouls them, the all-sufficiency of universal good is all-sufficing. Symbols are manifestos of a mysterious covenant by which the orderliness and consistency of all natures is decreed. Symbols are indeed the peculiar language of a transcendent agent. Men whose cars are unfit to hear the profundities of the Torah are permitted to behold the law graven upon the battlements of space, flashing from the stars, and inscribed upon every leaf and petal. The law thunders from the rocks, and in mournful cadence may be heard in the cry of the sea. All symbols are things standing for still greater things, the images of a transcendent perfectness, the witnesses of a sufficient truth, the evangelists of eternity. Symbolism, THE Universal Language 359. The Chambers of THE Mysteries. The ancient initiations were given in three chambers which signified the worlds of the body, the soul, and the spirit. After passing successfully through the hazards of the rituals, the neophyte ascended to a vaulted room in which stood the robed figure of the great mystery. Thus the secrets of self-mastery were revealed to the candidate. Chapter 16. ANCENTE Mystery Rituals. HRE Sophisticated Pharisees of the 20th Century Unseas. Ingly give thanks that they have outgrown the fables and rituals of the ancients. The worldly wise love the evident and are exasperated by that which is not evident. Plutocrat and proletarian alike regard themselves as victimized by that poor son whose words or actions they do not understand. They love the obvious because it flatters them, and hate the mysterious because it damns their intelligence with faint praise. Riddles are irksome. The modern cry is for facts, facts stripped of their verbal trappings and denuded of nonsense. Yet with facts for their fetish, the modernists are more foolish than their forebears. Decrying superstition, they are most superstitious. Rejecting fancies, they are the fanciful product of a fictitious age. The modern world is bored with its own importance, life itself has become a botheration. Having passed the saturation point of realistic culture, satiety is imminent. Suffering from chronic ennui, how can a world ever become interested in anything but itself? Smothered in their self-complacency, these all-sufficient ones ask for facts. But what facts are there that fools can understand? How can the helplessly superficial grasp the hopelessly profound, for are not realities reserved for the wise? For even those interested in philosophy today, we often hear the remark, we have outgrown rituals and symbols. They belong to another age, some previous cycle that has spun its time and long since vanished into the discard. But is it not more than passing strange that we should outgrow all that was beautiful in those worn-out ages and yet hug to ourselves? 361. 362 lectures on ancient philosophy. The same vices that they served all too well? We have re-edited and considerably amplified the first books of iniquity. But what of the book of beauty and truth? Why have we torn it from its ancient covers and cast it aside? If we have not outgrown the evils of the past, how can we have outgrown its virtues? How can a man say, I live in a new age and then steal more brazenly than the Spartans, intrigue more murderously than the Egyptians, kill more wantonly than the Romans, and oppress more heartlessly than the Brahmins? Apparently, ages do not entirely end, for the dregs of each dying era are dumped into the next to become the common heritage of new civilizations, while the best is all too likely to die or remain obscured, awaiting rediscovery by a philosophic few. There are times when memory is a carrier of carrion, and when committed to writing, this carrion becomes history. Not only have civilizations perished, but civilizations have also lived and exemplified some phases of the beautiful. We regard the past as having vanished like a dream. It seems to us unreal. But even as we say the past is dead, we ourselves die. The modernist cries, look to the future. We follow the direction of his finger and, behold, there is nothing. The future is an unfashioned quantity, it is the highly glorified now, the minute stepped up to infinity. The future is a great intangible capacity, stuffed full with the same substances of which the past is made. In the last analysis, both now and then shall pass away. There is, however, a strange philosophic now which endures, but the now of fools is but an instant slipping into then. The past is more kindly than the future, it is rich with memories and redundant with accomplishments. Whereas the future is the abode of the unborn, the past is the dwelling place of the immortals, for when man passes from the little now to the great then, he either sinks into a kindly obscurity which covers his faults with the mantle of forgetfulness, or his memory grows until men raise altars to do him homage and the ages resound with his name. The past is the security of the wise, the sure foundation upon which his feet are placed. The present is the slippery ancient mystery rituals. 363. Footing of the fool, for it passes away even while he stands thereon. We never outgrow the past any more than we outgrow our own childhood, for maturity is something added on. It is the complement, not the contradiction of that which preceded it. Remove the child from the man and he dies. For the child is the beginning, the point of unity from which all the rest springs like the oak from the acorn. The past is the abiding place of tender memories, of wise experiences. It is the fountain of beauty, life, and truth, and although this fountain flows through all the ages to make fertile the distant corners of creation, yet shall it never be greater than its own source. It is fitting that every man should venerate his tutelaries with some expression of the beautiful. The gods of elder days required no solemn convocation or bloody sacrifice, but rather conjured man to more virtuous living by inclining his soul toward those perfect rhythms which stream continually from the splendor of abiding destiny. The gods upon their eternal thrones rejoice not in the groveling mendicant mumbling threadbare litanies, but in the free man rich with the joy of living. Too long have the followers of a jealous and capricious Lord trembled in fear of his displeasure. Too long have men supplicated deity to spare them yet a little while before the inevitable loosening of his wrath. Too long have men envisioned their creator as human rather than /Vruman. When the sanctuaries cease to ring with the laughter of a happy humankind, the gods girded up their loins and departed. Too much of solemnity is an oppression of the spirit. He who venerates excessively neither loves nor understands the object of his veneration. To me, ritualism is essential to philosophy, not the ritual. Ism of a decadent church which had its inception after the decline of Greek aesthetics, but the ritualism of the dot indent. Pagans who served God with joy. Today we serve our faith with sadness, and if all the dwellers in the seven heavens were to perish together, the sound of our lament could not be more piteous than those funeral hymns with which we herald the 364 lectures on ancient philosophy. Glad tidings of our salvation. Never should we forget the story of the simple-minded jester who, entering the cathedral, and having nothing else to offer, performed his repertoire of tricks upon the altar before the statue of the Virgin. When indignant at the impious act, the priests sought to drive the youth from the church, a miracle happened. The stone figure of the Mother of God came to life and bestowed its blessings upon the adoring juggler. The substance of faith is not dignity, but sincerity, not formality but naturalness. Ancient religion was devoid of sermonizing. The words of the gods were not made the subjects of ecclesiastical debate. Tiresome clerics did not drown their congregations with a flood of pointless argument. A local exponent of the old-time religion recently offering their prayers and hanging garlands on the Hermes chose for his subject the vital question, which of the 12 apostles was the first to drink from the holy cup at the Last Supper? After first intriguing his audience by a few anecdotes concerning his own childhood, the minister analyzed his text from every conceivable, as well as inconceivable angle. At last, running short of time, he postponed his conclusions on this matter of pith and moment until the following Sunday. All the while virtue continues to fail from the earth, crime waxes strong, and there are ominous mutterings of new wars. The priests of the ancient temples were merely the custodians of the treasures bestowed upon the sanctuaries by the wealthy. The temple devotees came when it pleased them. Of the illustrious dead, in the presence of the images of the immortals, the thoughtful soul sought solitude. Into this inner silence there flowed a mysterious strength, courage to dare, patience to wait, vision to hope, fortitude to die. No discordant choir interrupted the ecstasy of enraptured meditation, no smug-faced deacons doled out the pews. Sanctuary was a place holy and inviolate, a plot of earth separate from worldly concerns where man might go to ponder the realities of life. Here all that was good seemed near, and all that was fearful far removed.